My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to this teleclass. We had hoped to bring you the socioeconomics of foodborne and enteric infections, but circumstances are such that this lecture will be presented at a later date. Our faculty for the originally scheduled teleclass is Dr. Paul Sockett, and he graciously agreed to present another topic today, one that I've been looking forward to, actually, People and Animals, a Public Health Perspective. Now, if you do a Google search for Dr. Paul Sockett and you also use the word zoonotic, you'll find that this man has been at least prolific in this area. Paul Sockett is the director of the Foodborne, Waterborne, and Zoonotic Infections Division at the Center for Infectious Disease Prevention and Control for the Public Health Agency of Canada. He is sometimes difficult to track down, mostly, I think, because his talents are in high demand at meetings around the globe. But he has agreed to make this time for us, and it's very exciting that he's here, and I'm really pleased and looking forward to his presentation. So from the Public Health Agency of Canada in Ottawa, to present People and Animals, a Public Health Perspective, I give you Dr. Paul Sockett. Paul.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul, for your very kind introductory words there. And good afternoon to everybody who's on the teleclass this afternoon. And thank all of you, you indeed, Paul, for the opportunity to address this teleclass today. Just a few minor corrections on your introduction, if you don't mind, Paul, in that there have been a number of reorganizations within Canada's Public Health Agency over the last few months, and what was the Division of Foodborne, Waterborne, and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases is now the Center for Foodborne Environmental and Zoonotic Infections, and a Director General by the name of Dr. Mark Rosine has been appointed to run that center. Anyway, enough of those issues. Let's get on with the teleclass itself, because we only have an hour. First of all, I hope everybody has a copy of the presentation available to them. This presentation this afternoon focuses really on a discussion about the public health implications of human and animal interactions. Also the environmental factors which influence those interactions, and then goes on to present some ideas and what I hope will be challenges on how we within the public health community and beyond should respond to the potential or indeed actual risks that these factors generate. The intent this afternoon is not so much to provide answers to the questions that I'll be posing, as it is really to fuel further discussion on some of these issues, because I think I certainly don't claim to have the answers on a lot of this stuff, and I believe that we will only find those answers in a multidisciplinary and collaborative environment. Certainly, one of the things that's happened recently is that the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization, which of course you know are linked, have been sponsoring meetings to discuss a concept called One World, One Health, which I believe is a broader international recognition of the role of the human-animal interface in infectious disease generation and transmission. Now, I don't believe that this is terribly new. What has been significant here is the WHO and PAHO bringing people together on a global basis to discuss these issues and to try and look at ways of moving forward on addressing some of the issues that are posed. I believe that the importance of that initiative as well is to interface sectors which include health, global trade and economics, and also the need to develop approaches to address these issues through multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder collaborations, as I mentioned earlier. Now lastly, before we actually begin the discussion, I just want to say that I'm drawing examples from my experiences in Canada, and although each country and continent has its own unique challenges, I believe that much of what I'm going to say in terms of concepts, principles, and issues is fairly readily generalizable. So if you turn to the first slide that's headed Animals Contribute to Canada's Economy, this slide really describes briefly the importance of animals to our lives, either economically, largely through the agricultural and leisure sectors, as well as through the benefits that we derive from owning animals as pets. Now, the numbers that are touted in this slide may indeed vary from country to country, but I would expect that the patterns identified would hold for most of the industrialized countries. For those countries with the largely agricultural economies, then the animal husbandry sector may indeed play a much larger role. Although, as you can see, with a population of 35 million, nearly 10% of those people in Canada are employed either directly or indirectly in what I would call the animal industry, covering farming, leisure activities through zoos and aquariums, aquaculture, parks, and nature reserves. The point of the slide is not really the numbers, but really to indicate the role that animals play in our lives, and that for most of us, contact with animals is a regular and frequent, if not daily, occurrence. And I can certainly attest to that personally from the number of mice that I've actually caught in my home over the last couple of weeks. So I'm well aware of how regular and those contacts can be. If we turn to the next slide, zoonoses in Canada, examples. What this slide again is indicating is that diseases from animals are a recognized risk. And in Canada at least, some of the key infections are notifiable nationally when they occur in people. And indeed, a broader selection of diseases would be found in Canada at a provincial level than is actually identified in the national notifiable diseases listing. But these diseases include bacterial diseases, viral diseases, as well as parasitic infections as well. And I've not included in this list some of the key enteric and foodborne diseases, such as Salmonella, Campylobacter, and veratoxin-producing Escherichia coli, which, because they're often linked to food surfaces most immediately, we actually forget are ultimately from animal sources. So the point here is that one way or another, we link to animals and potentially to the diseases that they carry in a very real way and in very regular fashion. Slide number 5, which comes next, talks about arboviruses isolated in Canada. This is a particularly large group of viruses, usually vector-borne, and of the over 500 species that have been recorded worldwide, we know of at least 19 that are isolated in Canada. Two of these 19 are midge-borne, midges are Culicoides species of insects, and include viruses such as blue tongue disease and epizootic hemorrhagic disease. 11 of them are mosquito-borne viruses and include such diseases as Western equine encephalitis and St. Louis encephalitis, which we see from time to time, usually in central southern Canada. West Nile virus, which of course has become relatively infamous in recent years and which we'll be talking about a little bit later in the presentation. And other viruses such as snowshoe hare and Jamestown Canyon viruses. And again, these are just examples of some of the viruses that we see. And there are 6 tick-borne virus infections as well, of which probably the most commonly known are Powassan encephalitis virus and Colorado tick fever virus. So this virus group, very large, and carries with it some potentially very nasty viral infections. Now those two slides are really a prelude to slide number 6, which makes the point that the risks to human health occur from a very dynamically interacting populations of microbes, animals, and people in what is really, again, itself a dynamic and changing environment. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that shortly. That changing environment is itself subject to many driving forces, which I've summarized under four basic headings. And the intent here is not to be all-inclusive and comprehensive, but rather to just give some direction to thought. So the first heading is climate change and the impact of climate change on ecologies, those changing ecologies on biodiversity, at least within those ecologies itself, and that the impact that this has in altering the checks and balances which are normally inherent in those ecologies, and the potential for diseases to spread out of those ecologies or to spread into those ecologies as a result of the impacts of climate change itself. And we'll say a little bit more about that later on too. The other heading, or the second heading here, is what I've called catastrophic natural events. And we've seen many of these occurring in recent years on a global basis, as well as a few here on our home territory in Canada. And obviously would include such events as earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, tsunamis, hurricanes, etc. And the impact that these types of natural events again have on local and sometimes more broadly wider ecologies, and the impacts again that those ecological changes may have both on human and animal distribution, and the potential for humans and animals to interact more directly than they would otherwise. The third heading that I've put down here is what I've called habitat disruption and modification. Again, on a global basis as well as within Canada, there's quite considerable disruption of natural habitats going on, whether this is clear cutting for farming or for logging purposes, or changes in agricultural system to grow cash crops instead of crops to sustain the food supply for a population, so going over to monoculture type of environments. These again have huge impacts on those environments, the established ecologies, and the potential for human-animal interaction. And the last heading there is what I've called human population activity. And I can speak from my own experiences again from where I live in the south of Ottawa, where we've seen a huge and rapid expansion of the housing projects in our area, devouring farmland at quite an alarming rate in some parts of the area. The issue here again is the encroachment of humans into the natural environment, the displacement of the animals that live in that environment, and the increased potential for human and animal interaction, leading to potentially greater opportunities for exposure of humans to animal diseases in that type of situation. If we move on to slide 7, the point of this slide really is to illustrate the potential mechanisms of exposure of humans to animal diseases. And again, I've summarized these under four basic headings, although I'm sure that you could probably think of more if I asked people to interact. Occupation is obviously one of great importance, with 2 million Canadians working directly or indirectly in the food production industry. Certainly some of those are working at the sharp end in agriculture and have direct contact with animals and are therefore directly potentially exposed to any diseases that those animals may carry. But of course, as the last of the headings, food and water consumption, tells us, that through cross-contamination, the broader population could also be exposed to those diseases. I've also identified travel and leisure, not just an issue for Canada within Canada, but there is certainly, from the statistics that we see presented to us by Stats Canada and other organizations, an increasing tendency for people to travel more regularly and to more exotic locations. Again, this has to increase the risk of those people to exposure to diseases to which they themselves are not regularly exposed or likely to have some level of immunity. And again, Canada, with its very large immigrant population, has a lot of people who travel back from Canada to their homeland to visit relatives and friends for holidays and for business purposes. And again, as people's immune systems become less exposed to the diseases that occur in those countries, the susceptibility of individuals traveling back to those locations may change, and there is opportunity for them to become infected with diseases which previously they may have had a level of immunity to. And lastly, what I've called casual exposures. These are the types of exposure we have maybe on a day-to-day basis with our pets, or in special situations such as petting zoos, petting farms, and so on. And certainly not that long ago, I was visiting a traveling petting zoo that had moved into one of our local malls and had set up there. And I was actually quite astounded at the lack of instruction to people who were buying foods to hand feed these animals and to pet them through the sides of the enclosure, about hand washing, and where in fact even hand washing facilities were located nearby so that people could indeed wash their hands or sterilize them in some way. So there are certainly lots of potential opportunities for us to be exposed to animal infections. Slide 8, which is the next slide, makes a different point, really, and that is that these interactions may not just be local in nature, but in fact can be global in scope. The slide itself shows the bird migration routes during the height of concern about the spread of influenza virus H5N1 in 2005, and the potential for migrating birds to spread infection globally via that these intersecting migration routes. And if you follow the lines carefully, you could see that it would be possible through those intersections for migrating birds to carry potentially the virus from the epicenter of infection in Southeast Asia, right across to northern Canada and beyond. Now, the fact that that didn't happen is an interesting question, and indicates that this may be a somewhat more complex issue than would appear on the map. But what the map does not show is the intersection between these larger migration routes and local migration patterns, some of which may only be a few hundred kilometers long compared to the many thousands of kilometers of some of these larger migration routes, and could potentially explain the link between the larger migration routes and the actual places where infection was identified in birds and indeed in people in the areas that are shown red on the map. As I hinted at a moment ago, recent research is indicating that the story is a somewhat more complex one than I'm laying out here. But the point is that to understand the issue better, we require something which I think is very important, and that is that people like public health epidemiologists, agricultural and wildlife experts, geographers, and many others need to come together and pool their knowledge in a common effort to improve our understanding of the ways in which these animal infections are transmitted to humans. If we turn to the next slide, we've already seen that these issues are complex, and this slide is attempting to simplify some of that complex, at least to an extent. What I've tried to do on this slide, and I've actually adapted this from something produced by Linton and Irwin a few years ago, is to describe four basic points of contact. These are identified as farm animals, wildlife, pets, and animal exhibitions. And it seeks to illustrate how these interact with environmental through the environment and can lead to human exposure. Now, I've left out some of the more specialized contact points, such as laboratories, just to keep this somewhat more simple. And because things like laboratory contacts tend to be fairly confined and probably less likely to feed into this broader mix of activity in the broader environment. But if we take just one example from this slide, that of farmed animals, whether it's cattle, sheep, swine, veal, calves, poultry, or other livestock, the products from these animals through farm effluent and manure can spread out into the soil and potentially infect wildlife through that direction. Through commercial processing plants, the recycling of offal and rendering materials can lead to further animal infection and can lead to potential infection of pets through consumption of contaminated products, or can go into the human food chain through, again, cross-contamination methods, infecting human food directly or indirectly. So as you can see, it's a relatively complex series of interactions. What I'd like to do over the next few slides, and if you turn to the next slide, which is number 10, is to talk just a little bit about some of the exposure points for humans from various contexts. This first slide talks really about the occupational context. And again, it's not intended to be comprehensive, and by all means, feel free to put your own stars and lines on these maps. But the point here is that there are a number of areas where direct contact with infected animals is a potential, whether these are people working in the farming industry directly as farm workers or as veterinarians, or people just having contact with their animals through, for example, pet ownership. So these are all, working in the pet industry, not pet owners. They come later. These are all potential occupational contact points with animals and potentially with animal diseases. Slide 11 looks at direct contact, which is not really occupational in nature. And it, again, indicates some of the exposure points of non-occupational direct contact with animals or their products. So prime examples would be contact with wildlife, for example, through the cottage. And we all know the potential for somebody going and cleaning their cottage in the spring, finding lots of rodent droppings, potentially being exposed to hantavirus through those droppings and through the rodent urine. Animal exhibition is one that I've already mentioned, and pet ownership is another one that's included on this particular slide. I wanted to point out one particular example which links into the pet ownership issue, and this is the issue of pet treats and raw food diets. Over the period 1999 to 2005, we actually had three outbreaks in Canada directly linked to infected dogs or dogs infected with pet treats such as pig ears, dry beef patties and beef jerky, the sorts of things that dogs like to chew on. And the identification of or the linkage of salmonella infection with those animals. In fact, although I've only listed three particular salmonellas here that were particularly associated with those three outbreaks, we did studies that later showed that there was a very large number, I think 25 or 30 different serotypes were identified in one study from a number of different products. And this again is an example of a great collaboration between initially the local public health people in Calgary and the federal agencies, both in identifying the issue and in identifying the source of that problem through joint investigations. And that has led on to a number of research activities which have engaged universities like the University of Guelph, for example, in looking more broadly at these pet products and identifying the salmonellas and other potential pathogens that may be isolated from them, and itself led into a further series of studies looking at raw food diets, a modern trend in feeding animals. raw food, raw meats, and vegetable products, and the potential for these to be contaminated and to pass on contamination to the pets themselves. So one particular study in 2002 found that 8 out of 10 homemade chicken diets were actually positive for salmonella. And another study in 2005 found 5 out of 25 manufactured raw food diets were positive for salmonella, but also a large number were positive for generic E. coli and Clostridium perfringens. So there's considerable potential there for human infection. And the way that this was addressed from a Canadian perspective was to actually engage the animal industries involved in looking at these particular issues and how they can be mitigated against by improving production processes and so forth and exchanging information. The next slide again looks at pets as an issue. And relates to a particular investigation that took place in 2004 as a collaborative activity between initially Manitoba and the public health agency, and eventually involved several provinces in investigation as well as the United States. In this case, it was a type B tularemia infection, which was linked initially to Manitoba bred dwarf hamsters and other small pocket pets, which were then moved across the border into the United States, where it was found that some of these hamsters were in fact infected with salmonella. With tularemia. When we began to trace back where the animals from these suppliers had gone to, we found a very complex picture of supply and retailing through several provinces in Canada from just a small number of suppliers and distributors in Manitoba. The point about this particular slide was not so much the outbreak, but the complexity of the animal movement through suppliers and retailers, the difficulties in tracking those, and understanding whose mandate it actually was to deal with this as an issue. Obviously, from a public health perspective, in terms of human infection, the public health agency and provincial and territorial public health agencies have their responsibilities, but in terms of understanding who's actually monitoring and tracking the pet industry, there were greater difficulties in coming to a good understanding of that. If we move on to the next slide, this particularly has a focus on food and water. And again, I've just identified some of the places where infection could potentially occur, and we've talked a little bit about that earlier on. One of the things I did want to mention, though, is that the Public Health Agency of Canada is currently involved in a study called CentreNet, which aims to try and better identify the links between the animal sources of foodborne diseases and what happens to the pathogens as those foods are processed and retailed and finally get into the human food chain. So this is in a pilot stage at the moment, but it is going to produce, I think, in due course, some very interesting information, and is really an example of the type of approach that we need to be thinking of in terms of understanding better how these diseases move through the food chain from animals to humans. And is an indication of the way in which we're going to take new approaches to trying to better understand the human risks and exposure factors involved in food-borne diseases. I also wanted to mention, as on the next slide, one more issue which is identified through the Walkerton outbreak that occurred in Canada in the May of 2000, when one particular town in southeastern Ontario was faced with a major waterborne disease event due to E. coli 0157 and Campylobacter, and affected almost half of the population and resulted in several deaths amongst the population. The issue here is the one that I want to show on the slide itself, which indicates the movement of the water from a particular farm where the organisms were found to the area where the actual well was that was situated, that was providing water for a, quite a substantial proportion of the town at that particular point in time. And this was in fact really a very unfortunate combination of events that resulted in this outbreak. There was had been extreme or heavy rainfall events which had occurred, resulting in runoff potentially from the farmyard itself to the wellhead via the route shown on the slide. Problems with the wellhead itself and damage that resulted in water outside the casing of the well being drawn into the well itself. The fact that that particular well, which was not usually the main source of water for that town, actually providing the water at that point in time, and poor record keeping and follow-up on the chlorination levels going into the water supply of the town. So it was a very complex situation. But again, one of the important things that it illustrated was that environmental factors have a, can have a direct link to human exposure, as in this particular case. If we move on to the last slide, this is the last of the key four exposure points that I was identifying, and this is I've called this one directly the environment. Basically, those contact points between people and directly with the environment, which has been potentially contaminated by either agricultural or wildlife, leading to infections such as Cryptosporidium, toxoplasmosis, leptospirosis, and so forth. And I've chosen those water-related ones because I've actually starred mainly the water issues on the slide itself and the potential for recreational waters to become potentially contaminated or even drinking waters to be contaminated with these organisms. The risk here is impacted by, again, by external factors such as climate change impacting and changing ecologies, as well as the potentially increasing the likelihood through heavier and increased rainfall events resulting in water contamination. And I've included in the next slide just a little bit more about climate change and some of the predictions for the prairie provinces of Canada for the next 40 to 60 years if climate change just stays at the level it is now. Of course, these predictions will change as the models change and the potential severity of climate change increases. But just in the next 20 to 40 years, for example, it's predicted that the prairies will become hotter and drier. There will be increased severity and length of droughts. And these, in turn, will lead to potentially water quality problems and scarcity, potential for food spoilage, changes in vector prevalence within some geographical areas, and the potential for those to increase vector-borne diseases. Allied to stresses on the human population from, for example, economic stresses and economic hardships from their perspective. And what this is really saying to us is that we cannot just now just think of now in terms of how we want to address these issues. We have to be talking at the at every level about what we need to be doing as communities, as municipalities, and broader than that, to better understand what these potential risks are going to be for the future and how indeed we need to address them. And in fact, the public health agency at the moment is involved in a particular study which will be engaging a small number of communities across Canada to look at the potential risks from infectious disease due linked to climate change and vector-borne issues and waterborne issues over the next 40 to 60 years, and engaging those communities on discussions about how better to address those issues at the community level. So that again is something which hopefully we will find providing us with some very useful information in the coming years. So the next slide really summarizes to some extent some of the impacts of climate change. We know that climate change will affect the distribution and activity of infectious diseases in many parts of the world, including Canada. We've seen in recent years, for example, the major outbreak of chikungunya virus in northern Italy. I think that was the first time that that had ever been identified in northern Italy. It's normally a virus that's found in the Indian subcontinent area. We saw the spread of blue tongue virus into Western Europe and especially the United Kingdom in the last couple of years. And this is a virus which had previously never been recorded in the UK. And of course, we've seen the whole issue of the development of West Nile virus in North America. Now, I'm not saying for one moment that all of these infections are specifically related to climate change. What I am saying, though, is that climate change can provide the conditions which will allow these types of events to occur and potentially occur more frequently. We believe that climate change may contribute to the emergence of new infectious diseases. I would qualify that potentially by saying diseases which are new perhaps to the ecologies in which they occur. And again, West Nile virus is probably a very good example of that. It's a disease that we had never seen in Canada prior to 2001, hadn't seen in North America prior to 1999. Now, I'm not again saying that climate change will cause these effects, but I am saying that climate change may permit these types of activities to occur. For example, if climate change allows some types of mosquito vector species to survive and proliferate in Canada, that in turn may open up doors for virus and other types of infections to occur. Climate change may also facilitate the importation and establishment of diseases and disease vectors into Canada. And again, I'm not saying it will make it happen. What I'm saying is that it will has the potential to allow it to happen and to allow diseases to establish within our own Canadian context. And, of course, many countries should be looking at the same sorts of issues, because what we've experienced in Canada is not necessarily unique to what other countries may experience. And I think it's going to be very important over future years to have a much better idea of the diseases which are occurring in countries, particularly those countries we travel to regularly or trade with regularly, and look at the potential for diseases that occur endemically in those countries, not to travel specifically to our own country, but whether or not the models that climate change is allowing us to explore, whether that would actually permit those diseases to survive and potentially even spread in our own environment. So I've shown you the particular example of West Nile virus on the next slide. What I've done there is on this particular slide, which I'm is to illustrate the spread of West Nile virus across the North American continent from 1999 to 2004. There was no point in putting further circles on the map after 2004, because they all describe the same line, and it just looks a bit messy. But what this particular slide does show us is the progressive nature with which that particular infection actually spread from New York, where it was recognized in 1999, across the United States into Canada and south into the American continent as well. Some of the key elements of this from a Canadian perspective was the ability of the virus to overwinter in overwintering mosquitoes in Canada itself. So we're not looking at a situation where we had to have the virus reseeded into the Canadian context from birds bringing it north from the United States each spring, but we actually have mosquitoes which have survived the winter and carry the virus and are able to seed the Canadian bird population and eventually human infection in the early part of the year. The other thing, too, which is interesting from an epidemiological perspective, is that after the initial wave of infection has passed through a particular area, that area may remain active for West Nile virus for considerable periods of time afterwards. And certainly we know that some of the initial areas infected in the United States and indeed in Canada still produce small numbers of West Nile virus human infections years after the wave went through those areas. This has taught us a great deal about the need to carefully assess the methods of surveillance for these types of disease. Surveilling for human infection, of course, is important, and we need to know when people are becoming infected. But more importantly, we need to know when the risk of human infection is increasing, so that the public can be warned and we can take preventive and control actions where that's appropriate. So, for example, we've developed monitoring systems, and provinces have developed monitoring systems, which are not looking at human infection initially, but infection in mosquitoes and birds to try and identify disease occurring in those creatures as an indicator that human infection could come down the road. We did a little bit of experimentation earlier on in the in 1999 and in 2000 to try and find the best ways of doing this. And some of you from the Canadian context may remember that we had sentinel chickens spread around the place, which was relatively unsuccessful in identifying the arrival of West Nile virus in a particular area. But we did discover that corvids, the crow family of birds, were in fact an excellent sentinel for the arrival of West Nile virus in a particular geographic area. And it also occurred that there were other sentinel animal species that could be looked at, such as horses. Again, one of the key elements of, or one of the key lessons that's been learned from looking at this particular issue has been the need to involve people such as bird ecologists, wildlife specialists, in monitoring the disease in animals and birds as an indicator for human exposure, and to set up networks and collaborations which would allow wildlife ecologists and specialists to interact with human epidemiologists to assess information which was being collected through bird and animal surveillance systems, and to assess therefore the risk of human infection. And it's quite fortuitous that having put these networks in place, they then became very important when the H5N1 avian influenza issue arose in a few years later. And in fact, some of those activities now support also the surveillance for the arrival of avian influenza viruses in Canada and North America. I'd like to turn to the next slide, which really talks a little bit about the impact of climate change on Lyme disease. This slide really illustrates the potential for human disease exposure risk modeling to help identify where and even when an increased risk of human infection to a particular type of disease could occur. In this particular example, as I mentioned, Lyme disease. Now, this disease, as I'm sure many of you know, is endemic in north central and northeastern United States, and there is certainly evidence of, in recent years, of increasing establishment of Lyme-infected ticks in neighboring regions of Canada. And if you look at the left-hand side of the or the left-hand map, you'll see basically the temperature gradients shown in shades of gray, within which the Lyme-bearing ticks can actually live and breed at this point in time. And the red triangles indicate the areas where the Lyme infected ticks have actually been demonstrated in Canada. And as you can see, they all lie within the temperature gradients that are shown for 1991-2000. What the map on the right-hand side indicates is that with climate change under certain models that we're using, those areas where the Lyme-infected ticks can live and survive and breed will expand considerably by the 2020s. And again, this is an approach to trying to anticipate risk rather than respond to the problem once it's actually arrived. So modeling these ecologies based on temperature is one approach to trying to better understand not only what the risks may be in the future, but provides a basis for deciding what types and if even what sorts of precautions should be taken to try and reduce those risks or meet them as and when they occur. And certainly various of the climate change models that we're working with at the moment would indicate further expansion of ticks established areas right to the end of this century. So, okay, this really begs all the question, so how do we respond to all of this? We need to understand the level at which zoonotic diseases, those passed from animals to people, need to be addressed and the mechanisms involved. And the next slide, entitled Zoonotic Disease Activities Operate at Multiple Levels, is an attempt really to just try and illustrate this. And again, it's not comprehensive, but just gives examples of how those activities operate or can operate from both the individual through to the family, community, national and international levels, but also the different types of surveillance activities or prevention activities that can occur at those levels. So, for example, in terms of surveillance at the individual and family level, risk factor studies and targeted investigations, such as looking at hantavirus exposure risk, would be one approach. At the community level, notifiable disease reporting is one way of collecting information. As we move up to the national and international levels, we're looking at broader collaborations for collecting and sharing of data to better identify and assess levels of risks. On the prevention side, again, the types of activities can vary at one level, at the individual and family, and even to some extent at the community level on educational and personal avoidance, such as we do regularly every year, for example, with West Nile virus infection, providing travel advice on vaccinations needed when traveling abroad, to local level enforcement at the municipal levels, to the development at the national and international levels of relevant standards, policies, and regulatory frameworks to try and limit the spread of diseases. So it's obvious from this slide that there are many types of activities that can take place at many types of level, at many different levels. The next slide also addresses the issue that we need to clearly identify who is or who needs to be involved in addressing these issues. And what I've done here on this slide is really just to, again, identify the beginnings of a roadmap, if you like, of the interface of human and animal health through the various federal authorities who may be involved in dealing with these issues, whether those in the agricultural and food environments, whether it's the environment agencies or departments, or whether it's public health, and underneath are these various specific groups or activities that take place. I think the roadmap, as the next slide shows, also then has to drill down and interface and identify those that interface on human and animal health at the provincial and territorial authority levels within Canada. In the United States, this I would guess be the state level, and identify the major organizations within these authorities who are involved in human and animal health. The intent here is not just to suggest the creation of a roadmap, which of course is useful in itself just so that everybody knows who's actually involved, but that then becomes the basis for the development of networks that can work together both in planning and prioritizing what issues to address and how best to address them. So in terms more specifically of the public health response to enteric and zoonotic diseases, what are the sorts of things that we need to be looking at and to address? So this slide, the points of the triangle basically point to what I think we need to be doing within the public health community, whether this is detection of disease and ensuring a rapid response to the disease issues and outbreaks where they occur, providing support through surveillance activities and targeted investigations to decision-making, whether that's priority or policy setting, or carrying out targeted investigations on specific risks to identify, well, what's actually causing that risk and what can we do to mitigate against it. This in turn needs certain things to actually support it and make it happen. These include, first of all, the horizontal linkages and multi-partner collaborations that bring together essential information, essential expertise, and allow that information and expertise to be synthesized into decisions and policies and so forth. We need the development and integration of surveillance tools and approaches that permit not only data sharing, but the rapid sharing of that data, the rapid analysis of that information, or even its modeling and defining of what the implications of that information and that data is. And links into the emergency response and support activities, many of which may, for example, in the area major events like earthquakes or rainfalls become increasingly involved in dealing with some of these issues at the sharp end. So that there's a broad spectrum of people that need to be involved in the whole public health arena and public health response. So what is it that the public health response must support? And I've identified some thoughts here. Again, it's not intended to be comprehensive, that we need to support and address. Well, I think obvious and has to be the identification of zoonotic disease issues, which are relevant to our particular our context, and whether that context is as a community, whether it's a population, it could be a vulnerable population, whether it's a municipality, whether it's a province, or whether it's a country. We need to have some better assessment of what the current and not only the current, but the upcoming issues are likely to be. And that assessment has to take into account some of the driving factors that we've mentioned earlier on in this presentation. We have to also be careful in evaluating our mitigation strategies to ensure that those mitigation strategies will be effective, and that we monitor them to ensure that they are being effective, and if they're not, then we have to put our thinking caps on again and look at some alternatives. I think we have to ensure that we use the information that we have in the best way possible to ensure that any assessment of risk or evaluation of a prevention or control activity is well science-based and fully explainable and reproducible. There may be a need, depending on the type of situation, to ensure that we engage others in dealing with some of these questions with us in the public health community, and those could include industry, would certainly include academia and government, all collaborating in some ways on focused research. I think there needs to be a better synthesis of science-based data, and I think one of the approaches for doing this would be to use risk analysis, risk assessment types of approaches for application to decision-making. And finally, the development of prevention strategies in both the animal and human sectors, which are both effective and appropriate to the context and the environments in which they're being used. If we turn to the next slide, these in turn require a better understanding of a number of things. I think we need to have a good understanding of what the objectives are of our surveillance programs and activities. What are the outcomes that we're actually looking from those activities? And to some extent, designing our activities where necessary with the outcomes very much in mind. That's not suggesting that we're going to predetermine the outcomes, but having a good understanding understanding of what the outcomes are that we're looking for will help us in designing appropriate surveillance activities to uncover the right types of data and information and analysis. I think we need to have a good understanding of the complexity of human-animal pathogen interactions, and I certainly think within the Canadian context, the increasing tendency to bring veterinary medicine and human medicine together in various guises is a very solid and an obvious way to move that forward, but there may be other alternatives away as well which you can think of. I think we need to think carefully about the type, frequency, and quality of data that's obtained. It's always a challenge in surveillance activities to ensure that the data that's collected is pertinent and relevant to the actual needs that we have. I think we need to look very carefully at the analytic products required in terms of the way that we interpret the information that's provided, the way that we use that data in risk analysis processes, and developing integrative and contextual approaches that brings together data from various different sources to enable us to better understand what is an essentially complex and broad challenges. I think the need for zoonotic diseases specialists within the public health arena, I think, has been well elucidated in recent years, both from the public health and the animal health perspectives. And we've seen that to be an increasing tendency. But I think there's still more that can be done there. And the needs of the animal industry cannot be ignored, whether these are farmed animals, leisure animals, companion animals, or wildlife, both in considering the welfare and the social and economic aspects of this, because if the industries themselves are healthy, then the chances are that will lead to a decrease in the risks of human exposure to diseases from animals. So I think in many ways, as the next slide illustrates, this amounts to a bit of a vision presenting some new challenges to public health, both in terms of vulnerability assessment of specific populations, and certainly one approach is to look at particular populations or subpopulations within the general human population and looking at their needs and doing the same thing within the animal industry as well. Presentation of information to more demanding clients is something that we have to take into account. Certainly, for example, the general public is becoming much more aware of infectious disease issues, wants to know more about what is being done about these issues, and we have to be prepared to meet that demand for better information and better understanding. I think there needs the response to regulatory priorities and requirements needs to be addressed, and even the approaches that are taken to regulation, etc., are key elements of our ability to respond here. I think the importance of tracing risks through global networks, given the global trade environment these days and the travel environment, means that we have to network better with other countries who we interact with via these mechanisms, better understanding their risks and issues and how we can work from two perspectives, really. A would be helping them where necessary and appropriate to develop their own capacities to meet those risks, and developing our own capacities to meet any risks that come back to us. And I think also the rapid assessment of risk in emerging pathogen situations is a need that needs to be further explored and developed, although that's certainly on the go and has begun in many contexts. So the last but one slide really addresses what I believe is a new approach to public health risk management. The traditional approach has been pathogen arrives, we see disease in humans, we recognize and diagnose it. It causes a problem which is through surveillance recognized as an epidemic, and then we do something about it. usually, when the issue has been well established, lots of people have become ill and so forth. Although there's always potential to curtail and limit the extent of that epidemic or outbreak. I think a more the development of a different type of approach is something that's occurring now, and this is certainly not my idea, but my observation of what is beginning to happen, and to a greater or lesser extent in many countries, and that is to work from a risk assessment perspective to identify and specify particular risks, to model or forecast what those risks are likely to imply, and when they're likely to occur, and to put intervention in place before the risk becomes an actual human problem and thereby present disease. And some of the modeling that's been done with, for example, Lyme disease that we saw a few moments ago would be a typical example of that. So we need to achieve this vision, and I think the only way we can do it is through effective networks, bringing together people working at local, community, provincial, territory, national, and international levels through various types of local government and international agencies, networking through the sharing of information and thoughts, ideas, experience, and so forth. And I think it's very important that we don't neglect other potential collectors of potentially health-related data. There are many of those that exist as NGOs in many countries and environments, and we should be looking to how we can better interact with them. So lastly, in achieving this vision, what are some of the critical success factors? Well, I think there's probably five, really. First of all would be agreed common understanding in Canada's context of what the zoonotic disease and emerging pathogen issues and imperatives are for right this moment in time and over the next few years. Then the development and maintenance of integrated and collaborative approaches to surveillance and response to achieve those commonly set goals. Thirdly would be a highly reactive approach to new public health and animal health surveillance and response needs. And I think we're already beginning to see that, that developing, and in some cases it already exists. I think we need explicit and clear targets for public health, animal health issues that are tied to current and possible future risks. And I think this is a great opportunity for the networking of the various agencies, NGOs, to actually identify what those explicit and clear targets should be. And finally, further development and maintenance of national and international information sharing and research networks. And we have the ability to do this now through various web and internet sources. So I'd like to thank you all very much for patiently listening to me this afternoon, and I do hope that I've at least provoked some thoughts for you. I don't expect people to agree with everything that I've said, but I'd certainly like to hope that it will provoke some discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sockett. And of course, we're going to agree with everything you said. That's the whole benefit of doing this as a teleclass. We can presume that everyone agrees with what you say. Thank you very much for that. Thank you all for joining this teleclass. And Dr. Sockett, thank you again for being willing to make this shift at the late date and still stay with us. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you all.
And until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.
Bye-bye.